Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Gerrymandering in the Equal Protection Clause Edition. I'm your host, Christopher Goffis. On May 22, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Cooper v. Harris, formerly known as McCrory v. Harris. In this case, the court considered a redistricting plan introduced in North Carolina after the 2010 census. Plaintiffs argued that North Carolina used the Voting Rights Act's black voting age population requirements as a pretext to place more black voters in two particular U.S. House of Representatives districts in order to reduce black voters' influence in other districts. A three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court of the Middle District of North Carolina determined that the redistricting plan was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander that violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause because race was the predominant factor motivating the new plan. Appellants contend the lower court decision against them erred in five critical ways. 1. Presuming racial predominance for North Carolina's legitimate reliance on Supreme Court precedent. 2. Applying a standard of review that required the state to demonstrate its construction of North Carolina Congressional District 1 was actually necessary under the VRA, instead of simply showing it had good reasons to believe the district, as created, was needed to foreclose future vote dilution claims. 3. Relieving plaintiffs of their burden to prove race rather than politics predominated with proof of a workable alternative plan. 4. Clearly erroneous fact-finding. And 5. Failing to dismiss plaintiffs' claims as being barred by claim preclusion or issue preclusion. By a vote of 5-3, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the district court. In an opinion by Justice Kagan, the Supreme Court held that 1. North Carolina's victory in a similar state court lawsuit does not dictate the disposition of this case or alter the applicable standard of review. 2. The district court did not err in concluding that race furnished the predominant rationale for District 1's redesign, and that the state's interest in complying with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 could not justify that consideration of race. And 3. The district court also did not clearly err by finding that race predominated in the drawing of District 12. Justice Kagan's majority opinion was joined by Justices Thomas Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in part and dissenting in part, in which the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy joined. Justice Gorsuch took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. And now, to discuss the case, we have Hans A. von Spakovsky, who is manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
On May 22nd, the court released another redistricting case out of North Carolina, Cooper v. Harris. And I say another because there have been so many redistricting cases before the Supreme Court out of North Carolina in recent years that even Justice Alito, in the dissent that he wrote, remarked on the fact that just one of the two congressional districts that was at issue in this case, District 12, that this was its fifth appearance before the court. So lawyers in North Carolina, those representing the state, those who have sued the state, have been before the court on numerous occasions. I think actually that is illustrative of the fact that the law governing redistricting, and in particular the Voting Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause and what a state can and can't do in this area is frankly very chaotic. The rules laid out by the Supreme Court are very broad. They are very confusing. And I'm afraid that this decision isn't really going to clarify things for lawyers in the redistricting field. And this decision comes out at a time when we are really not too far away from an entirely new round of redistricting, which is going to occur after the next census in 2020. So what was at issue in the Harris case was two congressional districts in North Carolina that had been redrawn, District 1 and District 12. And again, we should point out these were redrawn based on 2010 census data. So 7 years after the 2010 census, we still don't know what the actual and viable congressional redistricting map will be in the state of North Carolina. And again, I think this illustrates the confused status of the law. What happened in these two districts, and again here, I think it's important for people to understand the numbers involved, was that Congressional District 1 was a district that had a black voting age population of 48.6%. That was changed by the state by about 4 percentage points to 52.7 percentage points. It's important to keep in mind that North Carolina did have to add population to its districts because of the growth in North Carolina up until 2010 from the 2000 census. So District 1 increased by about 4 percentage points, went from slightly under having a black voting age population to having a slight majority of a black voting age population. The state also reconfigured District 12, increasing its black voting age population from 43.8% to 50.7%. So you've got about a 7 percentage point increase so that the district becomes just barely a majority black voting age district. Now, a number of plaintiffs in these districts sued, claiming that these were impermissible racial gerrymanders because race was taken into account in an improper way by the state legislature when they drew the districts. And so that brings us into the confused area of the law and what I call the Goldilocks principle of redistricting, because the case law on this from the U.S. Supreme Court is basically this. Race normally cannot be the predominant factor in redistricting because that would violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. This was most graphically described and illustrated in another North Carolina case back in 1993 called Shaw versus Reno, in which the congressional district there looked like a dumbbell with two large districts at each end connected by, in essence, a highway. So in that case, the court said race cannot be the predominant factor in redistricting, but it could be one factor to ensure compliance with the Voting Rights Act. The court said that if race was the predominant factor, then the courts would apply strict scrutiny, and a state had to show that the redistricting plan served a compelling interest and was narrowly tailored to achieve that result. In a second case, it was a second iteration of the Shaw case in 1996, the court said that compliance with the Voting Rights Act is considered to be a compelling interest. Now, in this particular case, the state admitted that it had used race in Congressional District 1 when it increased the district from a little over 48% to a little over 52%. The state said that it had done that in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act to avoid a lawsuit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. What was interesting about this is, and the claims about Congressional District 12, is that this entire case went through the state court system first. And in the state court system, a state trial court actually rejected the claims that Districts 1 and 12 were unlawful racial gerrymanders. That went all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court, which affirmed the decision under the state equivalent of clear error review. And yet, you know, here we have basically the same claims being made in the federal courts, and the federal courts coming to the exact opposite conclusion. I think that also demonstrates how fact-intensive these cases are, and also how differently different judges draw conclusions from basically, you know, what may be the same facts. Now, the state said that it had to draw District 1 the way it did in order to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The court, in a 5-3 decision, rejected that claim and found that both of these districts were, in fact, impermissible racial gerrymanders. The court went through the tests and steps that you have to go through to have a viable Section 2 lawsuit under the Voting Rights Act. And they said, the majority said, that the state hadn't shown that those requirements were met. In particular, of the three steps of what's called the Thornburg versus Jingles test for a viable Section 2 lawsuit, the state had not shown that the district's white voters would vote sufficiently as a block to help defeat the minority's preferred candidate. In fact, what the court said was that even at 48%, the black voting age population in District 1 had a history of being able to elect its candidate of choice. So there was no reason to put in more black voters into that district. The state said that they were required to do so despite that election history because of a prior case out of North Carolina, Bartlett versus Strickland, in which the Supreme Court had said that the Voting Rights Act does not protect what are called crossover districts. And that's what District 1 was. It was a crossover district. It was not a majority-minority district in which black voters were a majority. It was a crossover district in which a large minority of black voters, with the help of white voters, was able to elect their candidates of choice. While the state admitted that it was trying to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when it put a larger population of black voters into District 1, it denied that race had played any consideration in the changes to District 12. This is the one that went from about 44% to a little to almost 51% with the black voting age population. There, the state said that this was entirely done for partisan political reasons to help the Republican Party and Republican candidates, that it had nothing to do with race. The majority of the court disagreed with that and said that they believed what the federal district court had found, that in fact race was the predominant factor and thus an impermissible factor in drawing out District 12, to once again illustrate how different judges can come to different conclusions looking at this evidence. The dissenting judges, Justice Alito, the Chief, and Justice Kennedy, all said that, in fact, the record showed the Congressional 12 was not drawn due to race. And the fact that the state courts had come to the same conclusion, according to Judge Alito, he said that that finding, quote, illustrates the thinness of the plaintiff's proof. What was also interesting about that was that Alito pointed out a glaring mistake that was made by the federal district court. The federal district court pointed to the statements of two of the state legislators who had led the redistricting effort. They had talked about the fact that they were constructing Voting Rights Act majority black districts, districts with an S, districts plural. And therefore, the federal district court judge said, well, that showed that both Congressional District 1 and Congressional District 12 had been drawn for racial reasons. The problem was that statement, those two legislators, they weren't referring to the congressional redistricting done by the legislature. They were referring to the state legislative districts that had been drawn. Even the Justice Department that filed an amicus brief in this case on the side of the plaintiffs admitted that the district court had made a mistake in its characterization of the statement. Yet, as Justice Alito points out, that mistake was entirely ignored by Justice Kagan and the majority when they wrote their majority opinion. The other problem in this case, and this is something that Justice Alito points out, is that it is really difficult for courts to determine if legislators are redrawing a district for racial versus partisan reasons. The reason being, and this is a straight quote from Alito, quote, if around 90% of African-American voters cast their ballots for the Democratic candidate, as they have in recent elections, a plan that packs Democratic voters will look very much like a plan that packs African-American voters. And that, of course, that quote from Alito illustrates the problem in these kinds of cases, because under the law, political gerrymanders are perfectly acceptable. You know, if a state legislature wants to either pack Democrats or pack Republicans, as long as they comply with the one person, one vote standard, they can do that. That's perfectly legitimate. But packing African Americans for racial reasons is not. But when there is such a monolithic voting block of African Americans voting for the Democratic Party, it's often difficult to distinguish between one or the other. And distinguishing that is important so that the Voting Rights Act is not used, as it was intended, to stop racial discrimination, but instead is used to achieve political ends. And that is something that we need to make sure does not happen with the Voting Rights Act. The other problem with this case, and again, it's something that is going to cause confusion, I think, to all of the lawyers out there who are going to be involved in these redistricting cases in 3 years, is that there's a prior case, it's called the Cromartie case, in which the Supreme Court set a precedent in which they said this: if plaintiffs are challenging a political redistricting with a claim that it is a racial gerrymander, an impermissible racial gerrymander, well, part of what they have to do in proving the case is to present an alternative redistricting plan, an alternative plan that not only will achieve the same political purposes that the legislature said it was trying to get, and political purposes and an alternative plan that is consistent with traditional redistricting principles, but they also have to show that the alternative plan would have brought about a significantly greater racial balance. The plaintiffs in this case did not submit an alternate plan to the congressional plan that was being challenged. Yet the majority, in the opinion written by Kagan, ruled for the challengers despite the fact that they had not met that prior problem. This led to one of the harshest criticisms by Justice Alito in the dissenting opinion, in which he said this: a precedent of this court should not be treated like a disposable household item, say a paper plate or a napkin, to be used once and then tossed in the trash. But that is what the court does today in its decision. The court junks a rule adopted in a prior, remarkably similar challenge to this very same congressional district. And that, in fact, is what made this the most interesting, was that that rule, the challengers have to present an alternative plan, was in a prior case involving this very same congressional District 12. So the Goldilocks rule remains in place. You can't use too much race. You can't use too little race. You have to use just the right amount of race. But what we don't know is whether the Cromartie rule remains in place, that you also have to present an alternative plan. The court just didn't pay any attention to that in this case, even though it's a prior rule of the court. So it's unclear whether they're going to apply that in future cases. I guess I would end with this, and I think this is something that everyone needs to keep in mind, because it's really a good warning given by Alito. He says the majority's opinion threatens to transform federal courts, quote, into weapons of political warfare, close quote. He says that unless the courts exercise extraordinary caution in, quote, distinguishing race-based redistricting from politics-based redistricting, then they will invite the losers in the redistricting process to seek to obtain in court what they could not achieve in the political arena. Now, it's important to note that Justice Thomas did join the four generally liberal members of the court in the majority opinion, but if you read his concurring opinion, which is very short, it's only about a page and a half, it's because he actually believes that race should never be allowed in the redistricting process. He doesn't believe it should be allowed as one factor in the redistricting process. He believes that violates the Equal Protection Clause. And he does not believe that Section 2 of the Voting Rights actually applies to vote dilution cases. This is an important point because Section 2 originally was passed with the intent of stopping and preventing laws which actually kept individuals from registering, kept individuals out of the polls, kept individuals from voting, and really in recent years, it has pretty much devolved into a statute used for vote dilution cases. So these are not cases where individuals are prevented from registering or voting. It's cases where they are arguing that their vote is somehow being diluted and doesn't have the same strength or power as other voters. And Justice Thomas makes it clear in his concurrence that he does not believe Section 2 should be applied to vote dilution cases, because that was not the original intent or idea of the statute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.